An excerpt of All the President's Men, written by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. Barry Sussman, the city editor, was intrigued. He dug into the Post's library clippings on Colson and found a February 1971 story, which an anonymous source described Colson as one of the original backroom boys, the brokers, the guys who fix things when they break down and do the dirty work when it's necessary. Woodward's story about Hunt, which identified him as a consultant who had worked in the White House for Colson, included the quotation and noted that it came from a profile written by Ken W. Clawson, a current White House aide who until recently was a Washington Post reporter. The story was headlined, White House Consultant Linked to Bugging Suspects.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is, well, someone who essentially made the Rogue One to Star Wars for All the President's Men, which is, and incredibly, it's her first feature-length screenplay, which is kind of insane. She's a producer, has written the teleplays for a couple of the absolute banger episodes. 2.5 was my absolute favorite of Mindhunter, was the writer of comedy and Makes You Believe About Love, according to former guests of this show, Maria Lewis, the long shot. And I've since found out in just talking to her, is also a fan of Heat, so much so that she ran dialogue with her agents at a dinner with her husband. And for me, if her credentials aren't enough, Golden Globe nominee, WGA nominee, if those credentials aren't enough, she's basically worked with, you know, some of the titans of film in just a very short part of her career. And she's 4 months younger than me, which is just another piece of insanity. Ladies and gentlemen, All the President's Minutes would not have been complete without Liz Hannah. Liz, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thanks for having me. It's super exciting. I like the Rogue One comparison. I'm going to tell my buddy Gary Whitta that wrote this movie.
You tell Gary Whitta, a great Australian comedian and podcaster, Alexi Toliopoulos, gave me that. He's like, okay. he's like the Post is Rogue One, and I'm like, it just struck me like lightning. I was like, oh my god, it is playing in that same sandbox. It is people being inspired. But, you know, there are so many people that are going to talk on this show, filmmakers and film critics and journos. But, like, you as someone who picked up Kay Graham's autobiography and were prodded into it, I believe, by your husband. Is that right? He was like, you need to adapt this?
It was a little bit of both. So I had read her autobiography, Personal History, when I was, like, 22 and was, like, obsessed with it. Like, I just found it really striking to, like, read about somebody and hear somebody's voice that was frankly 50 years older than me at the time, but felt so relevant to my life and the things she was reflecting on. And so I was like, this has to be a movie. But, you know, I was 22 and B, I was dumb at, or both things. So I guess that's a reiteration.
I actually don't know how I dress myself until I was 25. So, like, I think we could all just agree.
I'm not sure how I dress myself now. So, like, let's just be happy that the 20s are gone. But so I went to write full time when I was a few years later. And then spent like a few years not selling anything and was like writing stuff and trying to get my career going, but it really wasn't happening. And my now husband, then boyfriend was like, and I was really frankly depressed. I was like, I can't get going. I can't get any traction. I'm not writing the things I want to write. Like, I think maybe I'll just go back to working in development, which is what I had done before I started writing. And he was like, well, before you do that, you should probably write that movie about Katharine Graham that you've been talking about for literally 5 years. and so I finally listened to him and spent, I've been researching the movie for years. I just had not sat down to write it. Finally sat down to write it in the summer of 2016. And then by May of 2017, we were shooting the movie.
Number two on the blacklist. Amy Pascal.
So I basically set myself up for all failure in the rest of my life. No way this happened. I wrote the scripts. Amy Pascal bought it, called me at midnight on a Friday night.
Can I ask you a question? Because you hear these crazy things. It's my favorite thing to hear about when people like, Amy Pascal's on the phone. Or like you answer the phone, like I can't imagine. And you know, I've had some surreal moments myself in podcast production or even just people that I'm talking to. so-and-so is on the phone. Amy Pascal at midnight is on the phone. You're like my first inclination, and this might be very Australian, but be like, fuck off, and just hang the phone, immediately hang the phone up.
100% off would naturally be my inclination. I've had subsequent very strange phone calls. This is definitely one of the weirdest because she was actually buying my script and telling me we were going to make it. It was just very weird. And then it was also 4 or 5 days before the election in the US, where, you know, it was, didn't go the way we thought it was going to go. And really, I think, frankly, Amy and I both were just stunned and thought we were going to make a movie about a woman finding her voice at the time that, you know, we had elected a president of the United States who was a woman and we were all rallying behind her. And that turned out not to happen. And for a very brief moment, I was like, does anyone want to see this movie? Like, is there any reason that we should make this movie? It turns out everybody hates women. Why would they want to watch this? And Amy was like, absolutely not. We have to make this movie even more. And so then then after that was on the blacklist. Number two, it was really crazy. My career was taking off. It was amazing. It was sort of giving me everything I wanted. We weren't really getting bites from directors. Like directors, we'd send it to some very high level directors, had never sent it to Steven Spielberg because he was literally making another movie at the time. He was he was preparing to make another movie. And then Trump was inaugurated and went to the White House, and genuinely from then on it was like lightning hit, because Tom Hanks sends an espresso maker to the White House press room every time there's a new administration. And when he sent it, he put a Ben Bradley quote on it. Meryl did a speech where she spoke about journalists and she spoke about freedom of the press. And Steven, who had been prepping this movie, couldn't find the lead of the movie, who was like this 7-year-old boy and had been searching far and wide for this kid for months and months and months and couldn't find him. So in this sort of crazy weekend, they all got the script and within, you know, 72 hours had agreed to do the movie. And we were literally shooting in less than 10 weeks.
72 hours. What the hell was your head doing in that 72 hours? Did it feel like you were drunk?
I kind of was, because I was really sick at the time. Like, I was like, I had the worst part. I mean, the funniest but worst part of the story is that I had like one of those end of the year or like beginning of the year like horrible flu cold things.
Yes,
and so was like hallucinating for 3 days. So this was like a horrible time to be told that Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, and Steven Spielberg were going to do your movie, because I was like, it's not real. I'll wake up. It's fine. And then finally, like, Amy made me come to her office at like 6 o'clock at night. And I was like, I'm on so much cold medicine. I can't drive. So my husband had to drive me. And I was in the room in her office and she was like, Steven and Tom and Meryl are going to do it. We're going to dedicate the movie to Nora Ephron. We're going to shoot this movie in 10 weeks. And I was like, I'm super confused. You know, it's like you get hit by a bulldozer. And so, yeah, it was crazy. It was a super crazy experience. And when we were in theaters, you know, less than a year later, I mean, the whole thing was just a whirlwind.
Yeah, I was going to say, from the time that you know, Trump is inaugurated, I think in Australia, because I'm part of an international film society, mm-hmm. I think I saw it in December. We got a screener in December. Yeah. So, like, for it to be running like that,
I sold it in November of 2016. We were in theaters December of 2017.
Oh my goodness.
It was crazy. Super crazy. It turns out you don't need sleep to survive. really just run on adrenaline at all times. I also, in the midst of that, got engaged and got married. So I made great life choices.
Keeping it really
poor
quiet.
Planning choices.
Keeping it real quiet. Not you.
Yep. Keeping it just really simple. You know, it was just a really simple year. Yeah.
But then it prepares you to go off and do basically everything else.
Yeah. I mean, the greatest thing about doing that movie was, aside obviously from it jumpstarting my career and it being everybody that you've ever admired on that set. I mean, it was, you know, my co-writer Josh Singer, who came on I think 8 weeks before we started production. Sorry, my dog is barking in the background. So Josh Singer came on, Janusz Kaminski shot it. Rick Carter was our production designer. Ann Roth was the costume designer. I mean, it was an insane amalgamation of people. And so of all that, they're all really lovely people who really want to do their jobs so their lives are better, not that their jobs are their lives. And yes. That was like a really interesting, important distinction and lesson to learn when I was first getting into my writing career, and particularly a career which I'm very thankful for the last 3 years has been really busy, and being able to learn that balance very early on. And, you know, Rick would take me aside like every other day and just be like, take it in. Like, just take it in, understand that this is crazy, understand that like you were at your dining room table writing this less than a year ago, but like appreciate it, and not letting me, and he wouldn't let me, you know, kind of get lost in all of the craziness. And so it was this really amazing experience, but I would say foundationally, aside from teaching me how to really be a professional writer, really taught me how to manage my life, or at least try to manage my life. You can call my husband after this and see if I actually do a good job of it. But, you know, we wrapped shooting of the Post on a Sunday. I started work on Long Shot on a Monday. And we were in production in that, it was like August, September, like 8 weeks later. And then, which they had been prepping that movie. I came on to do to work on it in pre-production. And so that movie was like, I think 8 or 10 weeks after I came on, they were in production. And then I was doing Mindhunter actually throughout all of it. I had signed on to do Mindhunter in the middle of production on The Post. And then that carried through sort of to the last 2 years. I mean, I didn't really stop until it dropped on Netflix. And it was like, there it is, everybody.
There's 3 years of my life done.
Yeah, exactly. God. So it was, and I had a couple other movies that I was working on at the time. And one that I shot last year, which was really exciting and comes out. I adapted a book called All the Bright Places.
Yeah. Another Netflix one that we're going to see in 2020.
Exactly. It comes out everywhere. I think it'll be in Australia and the US on February 28th. And so we shot that in Cleveland, Ohio in 2018. Probably, maybe we'll say that. We'll say 2018.
We'll say 2018.
And that was really exciting, and so.
And what's cool and also infuriating about Netflix is that we have no idea that that even exists, and that you've even done that in 2018 until like maybe December 2nd last year. They did that big like tweet thread of like, "Hey guys, this is all the amazing things that you can look forward to this year on Netflix at an undetermined time at the moment," and they just dropped that epic list that which had All the Right Places on there too. It's like that epic list of like who's involved and who's the writers and who are the directors, and these are all these great people that you can be looking forward to.
It's super super crazy experience. Like I've not obviously made a movie with Netflix, which is a different experience than doing TV with them. And particularly Mindhunter, you know, I only did season two. So there was kind of everything had been kind of kinked.
The kinks didn't work out. There's a machine there.
There's a machine going, and David Fincher, who is a genius and wonderful collaborator and teacher.
And a big fan of William Goldman and this movie.
Humongous. He and I have had many a William Goldman conversations, so I can attest to that. And he really deals with all that. So I didn't really have to deal with a lot of the release stuff. For Bright Places, I was like, what do you mean we're not going to release a trailer until 2 weeks before we start shooting or so it delivers on the service? And it's just not a process I understand, but they have it down to a science. They get it. And like the way they talk about it is so fascinating from like an intellectual standpoint. And then from a creative standpoint, I'm like, yes, but I'm getting bombarded with tweets from people who are like, can we see the trailer? And I'm like, man, I can't help you. I can't help you.
Netflix is going to, 2 weeks out, they're going to tell you when it's coming, like confirm that it's coming. And here's a trailer.
And then guess what? You'll be able to watch it forever, it turns out. So yeah. There you go.
Forever and ever. I love there's one thing that Ted Sarando said, which like is both kind of awesome and scary, is our biggest competitor is sleep. And I was just like, wow.
Wow.
Wow. Not
to forget be fair, my work's biggest competition is sleep as well. Yes. Because that's what the only other thing I'd like to be doing generally, or the only thing I'd like to be doing. But wow, that's crazy.
Yes. Yeah. Because they were talking, like, obviously now in a, I guess we're sort of, you know, with the Peacocks and the HBO Maxes and the Disney Pluses and Amazon Prime, like really flexing up to original content and things like that. Like the streaming ecosystem is going to change in the next couple of years, like how big an impact that's going to be. But, you know, one thing that they talk about is like, no, like our biggest competitor's sleep. Like we dial people in. We know the, you know, we don't have to release it necessarily, but we know people's algorithms. Yeah. We're firing straight into their recommendations. We're producing films that are just going to land with people, same act, you know, similar actors. It's like that HBO thing. Like you watch a HBO show and you might love it, you know, for example, if you love The Wire, you like watch The Watchmen and you just are so excited that people from The Wire are in it and people from Deadwood are in it. And like Netflix have a little bit of that with their acting backgrounds and stuff like that. But it's like, it's, you know, yeah, it's insane. And just the, a lot of, you know, a rom-com on Netflix that's good, like your upcoming movie, they just get eaten up and then you can watch it by yourself. Like it, there's no like cinema. That's the great thing is like, I remember my older sister, you know, there's that like sitting in your Jimmy Jammos, like eating ice cream on the couch with a blanket, like sadly watching rom-coms. Like you don't actually even have to go to the movies to do that anymore. That's your movie on a Friday night when it drops in February. It's like people can go straight to that level.
It's true. And it's like, I have to be honest, you know, I actually find, the theatrical experience really great, really rewarding. I love going to see a movie in theater, but like the people, like the talking in a movie theater, the like etiquette of being in a movie theater has changed since I like have gone. And that's really frustrating to me. Like, it's really frustrating to me. And I live in Los Angeles. And so you would think that people like actually want to watch a movie. And it's like every movie I go see, somebody's talking in the movie theater or whatever. I'm sounding so much like a, hey, get off my lawn old woman, but you know, what is it? It's my job. But so anyway, so like, it is really interesting. I also think to see what people will pay to see in theaters versus like what really does work on a streaming service. And, I'm really excited to be releasing this movie on Netflix. I think it really, you know, the movie is about, two kids, two teenagers, Elle Fanning, Justice Smith. And it's really about...
Both great, by the way. Love Justice Smith. Elle Fanning is so terrific. She's terrific.
They're insanely talented. And we were so fortunate to get the two of them in this movie and that they had such phenomenal chemistry and worked so well together. And so, you know, it's about their characters kind of discovering each other, falling in love through the reality of dealing with trauma and the dealing with mental illness and mental health. And, you know, I think those were things that we wanted to treat really, really with a responsible stick, I would say, and yes, be as informed as we could. And I'm really proud of it. You know, I think it'll be, I'm just going to prep people and say, it's a little bit of a tearjerker. So just get yourself prepared. But it's, for me, it's like, it's genuinely one of the best experiences I've had making a movie. And, the director, Brett Haley, is fantastic. And he's like, he's at times my big brother and at times my little brother. And that's probably exactly how it should be.
Exactly. Well, I mean, look, you have kind of had the insane career of already, like, yeah, I've already worked with Fincher and Spielberg and Streep. So no situation would be intimidating for you as a writer and a collaborator on set. You're like, I've kind of been with the people who are pretty much the best at doing this, so we're good. We're fine.
You can think every now and then you get thrown a curveball and you're like, huh, all right. So you are going to keep me on my toes. All right, I see you.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Well, look, we have to – we're going to dive into the minute that we're going to talk about here because it's amazing. And then I'd love to hear, you know, personal history by Miss Graham is such – like – the Watergate story is so omnipresent in her life as it is in all of the people's collaborators, you know, Woodward, Bernstein, Bradley, like everyone who touched this is their life. And so it's going to be incredible to hear you talk about it. This is one of my favorite little moments in this sequence. And I think, you know, for folks who are listening to One Heat Minute Productions and are listening to Increment Vice and are going scene by scene, for me, every moment of this entire preliminary investigation by Woodward is electric. There is some moment like accelerated heartbeat moment in every single part of it. And this little summation point, especially because Woodward, I think Liz and I said off air, it's like he's not good yet. He's not Bob Woodward as we know. He's still growing into who he is. And there's just, I don't know, I really want to dive into not only all of the beautifully like pacing of the dialogue and the dissemination of information, but there's just nothing like this whole movie is people supporting people who are passionate and hungry and maybe not great. And I love this for that scene. And I love the supportive nature of like lifting him at this moment. And these two guys, and I just, yeah, this scene's electric. So we're going to watch the minute now together. You guys are going to listen along and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Certainly it comes as no surprise to you that Howard was with the CIA.
No surprise at all.
Hunt worked for the CIA till 1970, from 49 to 70. Now, this is on deep background, but the FBI thinks he's involved with the break-in.
And what else you got?
According to White House personnel, Hunt definitely worked there as a consultant for Coulson. That's Charles Coulson, the prison special counsel.
Did you call the White House press office?
I went over there. I talked to them. They said Hunt hadn't worked there for 3 months. Then a PR guy said this weird thing to me. He said, I'm convinced that neither Mr. Coulson or anyone else at the White House had any knowledge of or participation in this deplorable incident at the Democratic National Committee.
Isn't that what you expect them to say?
Absolutely.
So?
I never asked about Watergate. I simply asked what were Hunt's duties at the White House. They volunteered he was innocent.
Such a great line to end with. I love that line.
There's sometimes when I do this and I like, it's like this freakish thing where it's actually made for that minute. It's made to end on that moment. They volunteered.
Watching it like as a whole. And then I love that line. I've always loved that line. And I had to go back and make sure that it was in the minute. Cause I was like, fuck, if this is like the next minute, then it's going to be really screwy.
Oh, there's some agonizing ones that have happened in the past that are really infuriating. Like halfway through a line being cut and you're like, God damn it. Really want to talk about it in this minute. That's okay. But
so I'll move you just real quick so I can plug my computer in because it turns out it's dying. Hold on 1 second.
I know. We'll be...
All right, go for it.
There we are. We are back. They volunteered he was innocent before anyone asked if he was guilty. What a line. What an amazing line to end on. What a great little exchange. And I love, even in the minute that leads up to yours, Liz, I love that line reading from Redford where he's like, and the CIA. Like when someone gives you information and you pretend like you're totally across
it. He's like, no, not surprised by that at all.
Not surprised.
It's I think the dialogue, I mean, just because it's starting on the last line of the scene, but is really, I think, the sort of fundamental line of that scene and is really, in terms of plot, the thing that propels the rest of this story, because he has now discovered that people are thinking about Watergate absent of him bringing it up, and people are thinking of this person involved in Watergate without him bringing that up. So he's like, he got a clue. It's our clue moment. And it's such a well-written, simple line of dialogue. It's not like, there's nothing that spectacularly written about it. You know, I mean, in terms of like flourish, in terms of anything, but it's so, this is what I love about simple dialogue. It's what I love about William Goldman. It's what I love about Sorkin does it, you know, sometimes, but often. I mean, You Can't Handle the Truth is an exceptionally simple line, but it's getting to the emotion of it and the point of it. So I think this line, the they volunteered he was innocent, nobody asked if he was guilty, and the way Redford delivers it is so both innocent and smart. And it's kind of like the first time he's really smart in this movie, where he's like,
he's just had his massive dressing down, a fantastic dressing down. He has to address that with Jack Warden's Harry Rosenfeld, and Jack Warden, who is usually a big scene chewer. Like, how selfless is it to just sit there in this scene from him as an actor? Like, it's like you don't have a line of dialogue in this scene for such a long time, and just to like to not allow.
Well, by the way, the Charles Pollock chair in the background has more screen time than he does. It's like a bright orange Pollock chair in the background. And no, I mean, it's his previous scene where he dresses him down is so great,
oh
where
my
he's
God.
Just like, God, kid, like, this is real. Don't tell anybody else you don't know this. And I love the part where when Redford turns to him and says, "That's Charles Coulson, the president's special counsel," just like,
and he just gives him a little wry smile. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It takes a lot, I think, to sit in that scene. It's funny, in the post, there's a scene very early on. It's the first scene of Ben Bradley and his journalists, and it's when they're finding out that they're not going to be able to go to Nixon's daughter's wedding because they've been disinvited. And there's like six people in the scene. And there's like, maybe there's like five people in the scene, but it's, you know, Bradley and four reporters. And like, no one really speaks until like halfway through the scene. But you've got like Bob Odenkirk standing in the background, just chilling. And you're like, we should probably have Bob Odenkirk say something. But like Bob, I think great actors, and particularly great actors in an ensemble, which this movie obviously is a Redford and Hoffman movie, but like the ensemble, how do you not talk about Robards? How do you not talk about everybody else in this? Is so fundamental to it. And that was so true of the post. You know, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep were leading this movie, but the amount of people we had in that film, like when I tell people the rest of the list, because they forget now, it's difficult. Yeah, no, we also had Bob Odenkirk and Sarah Paulson and Carrie Coon and Tracy Letts. And the sundry of other people that I'm blanking on.
Also, can I just say, I'm so happy for you to be part of the, like, there needs to be a reconnaissance equivalent of just putting Tracy Letts in movies and watching how awesome Tracy Letts is in just like everything. Like, it's like Little Women, Lady Bird, Ford v Ferrari, The Post. Like, just put him in more movies. He is literally amazing in everything that he does.
He's phenomenal. He's also wonderful. And like, it's really intimidating when you're a writer and Tracy Letts is there.
Yeah, it's pure surprise winning offer. It's just, you wrote August Osage County. Yeah, that wasn't influential or anything.
No, I haven't read that play a dozen times. It's totally fine. Oh, you're also an exceptional actor? Great. Thanks so much. I'll just see myself out. There was like one scene when we were doing the post, a boardroom scene, and Tracy came up to Josh and I and was like, do you mind if I just like change a couple lines here? And we were like, do you want to change all of them? Like, please, would you like the laptop? Would you like the final draft file? Would you like to do a pass? You can do anything you want, Tracy. And he kind of gave us this look and we were like, oh no, yeah, you can change those lines. And he was like, okay, great. But yeah, no, I mean, I think it takes a lot to be, you know, a wonderful actor and somebody who's used to commanding their own presence to sit silently in the back of a room. Mm. I would say probably if you're standing next to Robert Redford, you might be okay with it. But
especially at this time.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, the crazy thing about this movie is like Redford optioned it himself. Redford made this movie like on his back, and they made this movie also like, I want to say 3 years after Watergate. I mean, it came out really quick.
It's 1976 is when it's released, and if you look at the reviews, they're January, so like it's potentially December 75, like, you know, 1st of January 1976 is, you know, Roger Ebert's review, so you kind of go, okay, well, let's gauge it from like who are the big critics working at the time, and so it's very, very early 76, so then it's really 75, and it's being produced in 74, so while they're not only producing All the President's Men and then both men, as in Woodward and Bernstein, are writing the final days and reporting on the final days and assembling these things, they're doing all their pre-prod. They're just doing all pre-prod, getting things done, casting, all this crazy stuff, and it's just like, and immersing themselves in at Washington Post and doing that. It's like, that is a really surreal, you know, I think what you said that really resonated with me earlier in our conversation was like, I'm reading Katharine Graham's book and it's resonating with me, and she's 50 years older than me. And what I think is so crazy about this film is that it's so resonant, it's so powerful, it says so much, and these guys are like making it so hot on the heels, which is really perilous. Like, you think that so many movies making movies that are hot on their heels don't have any of that cognitive distance to like think about it, you know, and you know, you work with the great Steven Spielberg. It's like when he makes Lincoln, He's got, you know, hundreds of years and countless accounts mm-hmm. of his entire life to think back and look on. Even Bridge of Spies, you know, which mm-hmm. is obviously narrativized. You can play with that. There's so much material. But, yeah, I just think, God, to be in it and producing it.
It sounds truly horrible. It sounds honestly awful. It sounds awful. It's aside from it being an impressive piece of work, it sounds horrible to be doing that. And so cheers to them for taking that on and actually making this movie that it's, you know, people always ask me about the Post if I was a journalist, like if that's where it came from. Mm. And it's like, no, I just watched all the press. It's been a lot. And so I was just really obsessed with them. But like, I think this movie is fascinating in a lot of ways. It's really the distinction between this and the Post. And it was something, you know, Alan Pakula movies was actually sort of in general the thing that was really inspiring me tonally when I was writing the Post. And having it be sort of a 70s political thriller that we didn't see anymore. You know, those are my favorite movies.
Yes.
Pakula is probably the master of that era.
And everyone who does those movies is contending with Pakula. Like you look at The Conversation, the conversation that comes out, that's Coppola doing a Pakula-ish mm-hmm. movie. And, you know, even Michael Mann, who does The Insider, which I think is like, it's like this step relative of these movies that's made, you know, in exactly the same style, but just taking a completely different modern contemporary corporate malfeasance take on it. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, please.
I was going to say, and you know, if you look at A Few Good Men, which is sort of a courtroom drama, but has that kind of drive and Reiner did it, Sorkin wrote it, obviously it doesn't have the like cinematic weight that all of his movies feel in the same world of.
Yes.
Like The Pelican Brief is a movie that everybody should go watch. It's one of his last films and is for me like the thing of the last sort of 30 years that is the most in line of these political thrillers and these kind of 70s movies. It has, I mean, the score, the drive, it's got Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts. It's wonderful. And talk about it all the time.
We talk about streaming too. That movie, you know, I remember in the very first episode of the series, I was talking to Bilge Ibiri and we were just waxing lyrical about how The Pelican Brief kind of sucks on a TV. Like it's actually so deeply cinematic for a guy who's such a cinematic filmmaker. It's like, there needs to be like a more retrospectives on Pakula's life, basically.
In terms of like just foundationally of where The Post started, it started obviously with Kay and Ben Bradley and then with Pakula because it was like trying to figure out how to fit a bit of a square peg into a round hole of wanting to do a biopic about Captain Graham. I sort of am averse to biopics in general. Like I think there are very few that are really good.
Yeah.
And so that's a hard to just be like, I'll go write
because,
one.
Because the formula sucks. Like that's what happens is people get in the trap of the formula and it's like those ones that can be that can skate around it and not, you know, I think that's the real talent of like just thinking of contemporary movie like Ford versus Ferrari. Like that's like a, you know, it's got a lot of biopic-ish stuff, but it's like, no, we're going to just anchor it in a series of singular events or it's going to at least feel singular when we're doing it. So it's not, you're not lumbered with like, you know, they were born and then they had adversity and then they reflect.
You can't do the cradle to grave.
Yeah, no.
It feels a little, I mean, it's too structurally, I think, constricting actually because then you don't actually get to spend any time on anything that's interesting.
Yes.
But it's also not relatable. I mean, the thing for me about biopics that are successful, be it like I think Ford versus Ferrari is a really good example, which is we're taking a very specific point in these guys' lives and we're looking at it and that is the most relatable part of their lives, be it that they are, I mean, I sort of think all successful biopics are coming of age movies and it's like the moment that this person is changing into another version of themselves. And Ford versus Ferrari really feels like Damon's character is trying to get his footing in the next level of his career, and Christian Bale is sort of making a decision, am I going to stay like a crashy old man or young asshole or am I going to like, you know, move to the next level and really become a professional? And it's this sort of like, and they butt heads into this movie. And so I think that is like was really the challenge for me in figuring out how to do the Post with Bradley's story and Kay's story. It felt very organic to be a about the Pentagon Papers because it was really the moment where they became a team.
Yes.
But it wouldn't have worked without, you know, being obsessive about watching Pakula movies and obsessive about what that drive is. But the interesting thing about the Post is, like, it's not a paper chase movie. No. they have them.
They exist.
You know, it's like there's that. That was kind of a thing when we were in prep for the movie. We were like, so they just kind of get them. Like they just are there.
And then it's a hell of a lot of those great. You know, what I wanted to jump on was when you talk about your great ensemble and this great ensemble and this particular minute is, this is one of the first minutes that we see the big editorial powerhouses in the same room as Redford and Hoffman. Like later on, you build up to earn, you know, Howard Simons,
they're not
Harry.
With Bradley yet.
Yeah, we're not with Bradley. We earn the seat at Bradley's table. And so when you've got Howard and you've got Harry and you've got Woodstein together and you're in Bradley's office and then they're all of them, so that you've got the national leads, the metro leads, all the editors together, and those fivesomes, that's where the electricity of that ensemble, where you're like, oh, we got to get all these guys talking because they're all great in these moments. And so I think that's what I love about yours is, like, as you're building up, it's like the papers, the acquisition, it's the getting. And then those ensemble scenes are just the ethics, like our just massive ethical quandaries, just bashing against it. Like, what do we do if we do this? Like, what happens?
And like the genius of Steven Spielberg and in a lot of ways, you know, we talked about Pakula a lot, obviously, and there's two scenes that I feel very like connective to Pakula. One is when Odenkirk is on the phone and it's this like amazing shot. And the architecture.
Everything in Washington looks like it's soundproof. Like even the buildings look like soundproof stuff that you stick on your wall. Like and in Scott Z. Burns's recent The Report, it's the same. Like every building looks like it's like all these concave weird shapes, and you're like, this whole place is made for concealment. I don't, you know, you've got your pretty monuments, but the whole thing is like trying to capture sound so that people can't be heard in conversations in the street. Like that's it's crazy.
And when we were shooting that, we actually shot that scene in White Plains, New York. And it was like around the corner from where we had been in an office building all day or all week. And we turn around and it's like literally this DC sort of architecture and this and a very Pakula style situation. And we were standing in the corner and I turned to Steven and I was like, this is such a Pakula shot. And he was so like touched by that. And it's one of those. I've said a few things to Steven over the course of a few years where I just want to be like, you're Steven Spielberg, man. Like, come on, you know you're Steven Spielberg. But he's such a fan and lover of film and of filmmakers and storytellers and quite humble in his work that that was like such a compliment that I wasn't – I mean, it is a compliment, but I wasn't actually intended to be that that in of a compliment, and he was really touched by it. And it's because all of us really, no matter what age you are, if you're a filmmaker, you have grown up with Pakula and you have been influenced by him. And I think particularly for people who work in this sort of era and this type of storytelling, there's nobody who does it better. And so you're either totally screwed because it's never going to be as good as his, or you are lucky enough to sneak by and have nobody call you out on it.
Well, and it's also so funny because like they're contemporaries. Like he really bursts on the scene and Pakula has already been there. Like he's making his huge movies and big influential movies at the time that Steven bursts onto the scene. You know, he's making a completely different style of movie. And so, you know, they're talking about different conversations and styles, and people would have unnecessarily pitted them against one another at the time that they were emerging, you know, like going, oh, you're just the blockbuster guy and this is the guy who's making the edgy thrillers. But they would have probably been fans of each other's work, and that's just how they express themselves, and that's the reality.
That, you know, the competition and the competing against each other, which, by the way, happens in this movie between Woodward and Bernstein, which to be fair, is a little bit of Bernstein's fault. But, like, I think is, you know, is accurate in any medium and in any profession, and is super accurate in this one, and is very much, you know, like, well, you couldn't like that movie because it's not the movies you make. I'm like, dude, I'm at opening night of every Fast and the Furious movie. I'm in the center of the, like, I wish I could write those movies. I just don't know how. So it's like the idea that you can only appreciate things that are reflective of what you're working on is crazy to me. I would be so bored if that was all I watched. And like, I don't, you know, I wrote Mindhunter. It's really dark and depressing. If people think that's yes. all I watched for 2 years or 3 years, I would be, you're, that would be even darker and it wouldn't be good, by the way.
No.
So I think I completely agree. And I think in going back to this is like the competition. I love the scene where Bernstein just starts rewriting Woodward's work. And he's like, I'm not mad at what you did. I'm mad at how you did it.
Can I ask, and it's like, this is maybe a question for you and Josh Singer. It's like, how many times did you both say that line to each other? Like during the writing of the post, it's like, oh, just fix this line.
I'm
not mad at what you did, Josh. I'm mad at the way you did it. Like, I just please wish that happened. I want that to have happened.
It probably did. It's all a bit of a blur. It probably did, but I probably said it to Josh.
We're writing the people's history of the post right now as we're talking.
As it turns out.
So I think, you know, look, if we can get that confirmation from Josh, then that's what happened. That's exactly
perfect. I will get that. I'm actually seeing him in a couple of days, so I will get that. I will get that info from him. And generally, it was not because of anything he did. It was because I was just spicier about being than he was. So it is definitely not on him that he would have said that. It was definitely on my attitude. But no, it's funny, you know, like you become very, I think that's an interesting thing. I actually never really thought of with this movie is that like Bernstein and Woodward are very much co-writers in this and like very much teammates on this. And are also inorganic teammates. You know, they're sort of put upon each other. That's not like they're best friends and decide to work with each other. Actually very similar to how Josh and I started working together, which is, you know, I had never had a movie produced before, let alone a movie produced, directed, and directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. So there was a little bit of pressure. And Josh had
just come off the spotlight.
This little movie, it's totally fine. He didn't win anything for it. So he came on to help with the production draft and came on and set to be the on-set writer with me. And I definitely was at first like, whoa, 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 who's this guy? Who does he think he is? And then, you know, he starts writing and you're like, well, shit, this is, you know, he's actually good at this. And on top of it is like really... we've become very, very close friends and is really one of my closest friends that I have in the industry. And it's super frustrating because you just want to be mad and annoyed. But it's also this, I think, thing that you realize, which Woodward and Bernstein realize in this movie together is it's much easier if we do this together. Like we actually can do more, we can accomplish more, and we can have a more well-rounded perspective on this if we're doing it together and if we're dividing and conquering and if we're just, you remove your ego from everything and you just do it to make it better.
I love exactly what you said there about the ego. Like that's so, like that ego moment of like, and in the movie they underscore it even more than the passing line in the book, because I think what's great of like it's a co-written, obviously the co-written book is like Woodward writes his was better. And so I think there's just a moment where just going like, no, his was better, and that is not, that's not a slight against me. It's like, we're working on this together. So like, just be better. Like I'll just be better. And the next time I file, I'll learn and I'll make it better. And so there's something so like, there's a great solidarity that comes in that. And I just love these two guys complimenting each other. And I love what you said. It just, it's funny that the moments that you think of that trigger thoughts about other parts of the movie, it's like, they're not identical people. Even when Bernstein, like an hour and 10 minutes in this movie, finds out that he's a Republican, you know, like looks at him.
It's one of my favorite parts.
It's like, what? Like, what? Yeah. Like, we've done hours together, you know, countless hours on the road. It's like, I'm a Republican. Those moments too, like that complimentary thinking, that stuff, I love it. And, you know, I think what you explained with Josh and what people get shocked about, and it's like when you research people like Spielberg, is this deeply successful guy who's like foundational to our culture is like super collaborative and just likes good ideas and doesn't really have much of an ego about where those great ideas come from. And it's more about like, let's give it a go. And you hear about it with Martin Scorsese, it's like, oh, we'll give it a go. And people feeling more relaxed to be more collaborative, to just have the best ideas and the best version of everything. And it's just kind of, it feels counterintuitive to what you get taught about that. Like you're taught that, no, they're a visionary and they're so staunch on what they've got. And then what you learn in the practicality is like, no, we might have a staunch vision for what is on the page, so we're going to do that, but then we'll flex, you know, to try and get the best ideas in, and then we'll move on to the next thing. It's just this crazy.
I think it also, you're 100% right. It's also, I think we're brought up again in this competition. Like it's so competitive to get to be a place where you're actually doing the thing that you want to do.
Yes.
And, but I think it's also just, he's very secure in what he does. And I think he's a confident person without being egotistical and without having to have everything be about him. And that I think is really, you know, the set for The Post was just so calm and so collaborative and so, you know, I mean, Janusz and Stephen have been working together for 75 years and you know, they, the whole Adam Sumner, our assistant director, has been working with them, I want to say, since Saving Private Ryan. So I mean, there's,
yeah. So like so, basically yeah, 20 years on the button.
Exactly. So it's just, there's a consistency to this world and the people that are in it that removes kind of the feeling of competition, because everybody knows like this is a place where we're all making it better and nobody's ever worried about their toes getting stepped on and nobody's worried about, well, that was their idea and da 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 da. And so it's very, and by the way, David Fincher is very similar. You know, I had no idea what working with Fincher would be like. I knew there'd probably be more than two takes, but that was about it. And I met with David to come on to Mindhunter, and I don't think we talked about the show at all. You know, I think we talked about like football. We're both humongous sports fans, so we just talked about sports for like an hour and a half, and then I left, and I was like, I don't know if I got the job, but I think so.
We had a great chat. Like we had a really good chat.
And then what developed from that was really, I think, an understanding that we understood each other sort of as people, and from that could understand how to make something better or make something that we both wanted to make. And obviously had a number of other amazing writers on the show with us. And so it's similar, you know, I just don't think there's any ego involved when you're trying to make a good project. On All the Bright Places, the movie that February 28th is on Netflix. That movie, like, we were rewriting that script every day. I was on set, and it was Elle and Justice and Brett Haley, and I would be writing the scenes every morning while I would be writing, and they would be telling me how to make it better. And it was all to make it better. There was no, and the amazing thing about that was, like, we had a really good script that I co-wrote with Jennifer Niven, who is the author of the novel. And we had a great script, and it was just like, let's take an hour and make it better. And there's a ton of ways I could have had a huge ego about, like, no, this is what you say. Brett could have had a huge ego of, like, you're going to say exactly what I want you to say. Ellen Justice could have just been like, we're not saying any of that. You know, there's any where this could have gone wrong. But instead, it was super collaborative and super, like, steeped in respect for each other and respect for the material and the hope of just making it as good as we could. So I think this idea of, like, ego and collaboration are counterintuitive ideas.
Yes.
And you can't be collaborative if you're constantly worried about getting credit or constantly worried about your own ego being satisfied. And you can't have, in my opinion, the best material unless you are being collaborative, because film and television is a visual medium. And if I just wanted to write things, I would be a novelist or, yeah, you know, and it would sit in my drawer and I would not be successful at all. So I think that's something that's really interesting about All the Presidents Men, is like, it's an arranged marriage. It's not a partnership that is forged in, you know, real deep friendship. And they're not actually friends. Like, they don't have these moments that, you know, they have moments throughout the movie, but they don't have these big,
there's solidarity, but they're not mates. They don't hang out together.
Exactly. I will also say that I think I just realized that the scene in Long Shot where O'Shea Jackson Jr. says he's a Republican might have been lifted. I think I just realized that.
I was going to say, I love O'Shea Jackson so much. And in your movie, he's so good. And that scene made me laugh. That was the scene that made me laugh out loud in Long Shot. I was like, what? What?
It's just so great. I love that scene. For people who haven't seen it, I'm not going to ruin for you what happens. You should just watch it. It's probably on Netflix, or you could buy it somewhere.
But I would probably bet, I'm going to bet money that if it's not on Netflix, it'll be there by February 28th. So that in the algorithm,
there you go.
Once you've watched,
I bet you, yeah.
All the Bright Places, you're going to go, oh, cool. What's up?
Yep.
What's up next? Mindhunter and The Long Shot.
That's going to be a really interesting triptych for them. I'm just going to say, I think that scene might have been affected by All the President's Men. That's an interesting discovery I just made. See? New things you learn every day.
New things you learn right now and in this movie and in this scene. One final question, I guess, that I wanted to talk to you about, or one final sort of element that I wanted to talk to you about, is because because this was inspired out of that moment and there was that urgency from Amy Pascal that you discussed early on, it's like, this movie now continues in 2020 as another election is coming up. Mm-hmm. And as we're talking today, it is the 5th of February in Australia. It's still the 4th mm-hmm. of February in America. And there's a whole debacle in Iowa right now about a Democratic caucus that is just like spitting out content and confusion and like baffling political, like filibuster victory laps when no one even knows what the hell's going on. Why do you think?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say that the Democratic Party was disorganized?
Just to be clear.
Yeah. Okay.
Why do you think? Why do you think these movies? And having that sort of these movies like ethical quandaries about relationship between journalism and politics, like The Post and Presidents. Why are these now like comfort food in our lives? Like, what is it, just the overwhelming flood of information that we get that like when people are actually stopping, pausing, deciding what the right thing to do is with this information, is that just like what we're completely missing in our day-to-day being bombarded with things? Is that like your feeling of it? Because I never thought I'd hear it, but I'm now with, this is now the 19th minute of the show, and I keep hearing, oh, it's like comfort food, and like, no, this isn't meant to be comfortable. It's meant to be scary.
No, by the way, Richard Nixon is almost impeached. Richard Nixon has to leave the White House because of this and resign from office. So I don't know. I would call it comfort food, but comfort food, because he shouldn't have been president. But I truly believe it's because we live in a world now where nobody knows what, there is no like definition of right and wrong. Tom Hanks said something really great when we were doing the press tour of The Post, which is super sad, but I think very accurate, which is the North Star is no longer North anymore. And there is no agreement on what true and false is.
Yes.
And it's very disheartening to be somebody who, look, frankly, like I grew up in a super patriotic family. My father was in the military. My grandfather was a career Marine. Grew up in a very liberal household where the Kennedys and basically every liberal from the 60s was on our walls. So it's super weird that I wrote a movie about them. But for me, it's just, it's a disintegration of the values that I grew up with. And I think all of us hopefully grew up with, or the smart, articulate, non-insane ones did. And so I think watching All the President's Men is like, oh, the good guys won and the truth won out. And it's also an underdog movie. It's the story of, these two guys who like really, one of my favorite scenes in the movie we haven't talked about is like the first scene that Ben Bradley is looking at their article,
the red pen.
And he's redlining it. Ugh. And he's in a tuxedo and he like looks so dope. And they're just, and they just keep looking at, they like keep staring at him like, oh my God, Ben Bradley is reading something I've written. And like, they keep kind of like looking over at each other. And Dustin Hoffman's so great in it. You can tell that he's just obsessed with Bradley.
He's freaking out in that scene. Such a good performance by him to be so deeply freaked out.
It's so great. But like, these are two guys who were not, you know, they weren't the heroes. They weren't the ones who were getting the call to do this. They were the ones who randomly got this call because nobody else was interested in it. Yes. And because Redford was in the right place at the right time to, you know, be in court. But so I think it's about underdogs. And I think in terms of the post, you know, when we made that movie, again, it came out in the end of 2017. And then again, it was like December 2017 and January 2018, it went wide. And we were entering year two of the travesty that is the presidency of the last 4 years. And we're really not thinking it would last this long.
Yeah.
At least I wasn't. You know, I don't want to speak for everybody. I'll just say I did not anticipate, you know, I would have hoped we could get to an impeachment process because, just spoiler alert, he broke the law about 9,000 times before, you know, the left.
Spoiler alert. I don't think it's a spoiler at this point.
Yeah. So I had anticipated potentially getting there, but it took this long and it's not going well. And so it's you don't see bravery apparently anymore. For what's right, you see politics and you see this fundamental disinterest in the truth. And you know, I've been watching, of course, the impeachment trial constantly. And you these Republicans sort of yesterday, a couple of them said that Trump did do something wrong.
But it's not worth impeaching. And you're like,
yeah, but it's not worth it. And it's like, well, but you just said he did something. Like then he should be impeached. You said he did something wrong. So
if the law's been broken, like,
there you go. There's not really a gray area in that. So I do think in this, it's sad, but I now have come around to the idea that these movies being comfort food, because it's nice to see, you know, that truth still exists. You know, the irony of the post is that a lot of Republicans really like it and don't find the connection to what we were trying to say. So, you know.
But also, I don't think you're saying something. This is what's good about both movies, is that people quickly shed their political allegiances for what's right and wrong in this movie.
Yes,
both movies.
Yes. Yes.
You
yes,
actually absolutely. Argue what is right and what is wrong. What is right for yes. us to say is this.
Yes.
It is more powerful for us to contend with the truth than it is to just accept that, oh, okay, well, my political allegiances are one way. And that's everyone. That's the amazing bookkeeper. That's Hugh Sloan. That's, you know, so mm-hmm. Jane Alexander and Stephen Collins. And you know, it's then, you know, Penny Fuller, Sally Aitken, like, spilling the mm-hmm. beans on, you know, who wrote the Canuck letter. It's like, people did illegal mm-hmm. stuff. And just because I might have a political allegiance or a friendship allegiance, it was like, it's wrong. It's like, yeah. it's wrong. And so we have to treat it that it's wrong and hold them to account. And so I think that a lot of time what's happening in the modern conversation is that people's allegiances are first, and like it takes so much longer to get to what is morally right about something.
Yeah, and that should be really the first conversation and potentially the only conversation.
Yeah, what's right and wrong?
What's right and wrong? And I think the thing I'm really proud of the post is that there's a number of things I'm really proud of, but one of them is that we did make a movie about how it is hard to make that decision. It is not easy to make the morally right decision at all times. No. It is, you will put yourself, potentially your family, your company, you know, whatever it is. I was just about to do the line, whatever the line, the Paulson line in the movie. But so you could put all those things in jeopardy. But at the end of the day, you are then choosing to say that it is right, that what is wrong is right if you don't act on it. And that, I think, is the line that I try and hold myself accountable to. And I think we all should hold ourselves accountable to, again, like, regardless of affiliations, regardless of friendship, regardless of political party, you know, and I don't mean to say that all Republicans, by the way, are, Trump supporters. So I don't want to put them in that Venn diagram, but I am surprised when Trump supporters like the post. It's a slightly I think it probably leads into,
you know, there's a whole other conversation that we could have, but I think it like just from you, when you try and look at it the most empathetic lens, it's like people know what right and wrong is, and for whatever reason you vote for a guy because you think it's going to be positively disruptive, like lots of things that happen in the world, and then you actually see the nuts and bolts what's happening, and you're like, nope. that was a bad decision. And people don't like to say that they're wrong, even when they're wrong.
Yeah, when they're really wrong. I mean, I think people actively, when they don't want to say it, when they know they're wrong. But no, and by the way, I'm not saying like I'm perfect or that I'm standing on a moral high ground.
No, I don't think, sure I don't think anyone who's hearing this is thinking that, by the way.
By the way, they're like, no, I listened to you for 45 minutes. I know you're definitely not perfect.
No, I don't think that's the case. But I just, it's, look, you said one thing, two things that were deeply right. O'Shea Jackson Jr. is amazing. And Ben Bradley looks, you know, Ben Bradley as Robards in that suit is dope. Yep. Like there's the, like that is... I think about that so much. I think, could I ever pull off a suit like that? Could I ever put my feet so with such swagger on a table and cross things out in red pen? I don't think I'll ever be that cool in my entire life.
So much swagger. It's just, it's so crazy.
It's stupid. It's
like,
stupid.
It was when Hank signed on to do the movie, we had a long conversation because he was like, how do I do this after Robards? And he actually had a dinner one time with Robards was it Robards? Now I can't remember if it was Bradley or Robards, but he met Ben Bradley once and he had, I think, a dinner with Robards, and he's like, he was the coolest man that ever existed. Like just, and so like him playing Bradley was really easy because he was just like, I'm playing another cool dude. It's fine. But I definitely am never going to be as cool as Ben Bradley or Jason Robards. I'm comfortable with that.
Well, that has been the 19th minute of All the President's Minutes, covering the amazing All the President's Men with the awesome Liz Hannah. Liz, writer of the Post, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. This has been a ripper of a conversation, and I feel like we're just like one step closer to like actually having the project ticking many bucket lists with you being on the show, because having someone who's so deeply familiar with everything about this movie from the Post and everything about this time, it's just really cool to talk to you. And you've written words for characters who are in this movie, so it's very, very cool. Cool to chat to you.
That's scary.
It's scary, right? Yeah. I'm sorry to scare you, but thank you so much for being a part of the show, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much to the incredible Liz Hannah for being a part of the show. If you want to follow Liz, you can find her on Twitter at It's Liz Hannah. That's the best place to find her. Of course, The Post is available on streaming, as is Longshot, as is her brand spanking new film on Netflix, All the Bright Places. And you can also check out her other show, The Dropout, on Hulu. Liz, thank you so much for your generosity. Really appreciate it. And give Liz a follow, huh? Thank you so much again for listening to All the President's Minutes and anything on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and producer of Increment Vice, as well as everything that's been happening on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. If you want to follow me, simply go to @OneBlakeMinute on Instagram and on Twitter, or to OneHeatMinute.com to find out everything that's happening with the show and about the show. If you guys want to support us, we have a link on OneHeatMinute.com to our Patreon. If you can spare even a couple of bucks a month, the cost of a coffee a month, you are going to be contributing to this show, the amazing Increment Vice, and any other amazing shows that are a part of One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much in advance. If you can't support us, you don't have the cash, that's totally fine, but please subscribe, rate, review, and share the shows. We would love, if you are digging the show, share them with like-minded film folk around the place. Thank you so much once again for listening to this episode. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes and another episode in the One Heat Minute Productions feed very soon.